50 years ago this month, America heard these words delivered from the steps of the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C.
I have a dream that one day on the red hills of Georgia, the sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood. I have a dream.
Dr. King articulated the dream of integration 50 years ago, and there's no doubt we've come a long way. But despite so many good intentions, despite passage of an entire body of civil rights legislation, the disheartening truth is that even today, black people and white people often just don't spend that much time together. A recent Reuters poll found that 40% of white people have only white friends. I know we all have the tragedy of Trayvon Martin in our minds, so maybe this is a good time to examine ourselves and our lives more deeply, to ask what kind of subtle, maybe unrecognized barriers prevent us from living Dr. King's dream. I'm Anne Strainchamps, and my guest this morning is Tanner Colby. He's a former advertising executive, a writer, and the author of a book that deserves to be read widely. It's called Some of My Best Friends Are Black. And Tanner, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's our pleasure. So this book, the way you tell it, kind of grew out of a revelation. You woke up one day and realized that you didn't have any black friends?
Exactly.
How is that even possible?
How is it possible? Well, I'm a middle-class white person in America. It's very possible, as the Reuters poll shows you. In fact, I was surprised when that poll came out. I was surprised the numbers were as good as they are. And I think it's slightly skewed in people's favor, because it specifies non-white friends. And, you know, I've had Asian, Hispanic, and Middle Eastern friends my whole life. I've never written a book about it. That's not really that big of a deal. But the gap between black and white is much bigger and much deeper.
And this despite the fact that you live in New York City, one of the most multiracial cities in the world.
And one of the most segregated.
Did you have go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say, did you have, when you, you know, had your revelation and thought, wow, do I have any black friends? Did you have a moment of thinking, am I a closet racist?
No, not at all, because I wasn't, and I'm not now. I don't think I'm actually any less racist for having written the book. I'm just more educated. You know, it was, I was just curious as to why it had happened, because I had never actively sought to avoid black people, and, you know, it's not like I came from a wealthy background of living in, you know, gated communities and restricted country clubs. You know, I'm just sort of a normal middle class white person. And if integration had worked, if black people had been given access to, you know, mainstream avenues of opportunity, then, you know, the areas where I lived ostensibly would have been where they would have showed up. And very few did. So I thought that was an interesting way to go and a lens to go back and look at this history, because we normally only look at it from the black side of the aisle and to look at it more from the middle class white person point of view, saying, okay, you know, where is everybody?
Yeah. And the other thing that I really like about what you've done is, you know, conversations about race are often so loaded and so emotional. And you seem to have decided to really look at the structural reasons, not to, you know, not that it didn't involve some soul searching, I suppose, but really mm-hmm. to look at what structural reasons might exist for the fact that you live a very segregated white life.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think I sort of approached it. Part of the problem with, quote, the national conversation about race and a lot of what's written about race is that it all comes from a very ideological point of view. Especially if you're white, to wade into the racial debate, you're usually motivated by some sort of left-wing or right-wing ideology that leads you to get into it. And that's actually a very safe place to approach it, right? Because you have the armor of this dogma that you can surround yourself with. But I was just curious. I didn't really approach it from an ideological point of view. So I would, you know, when topics get so heated and the people who've been dealing with them for decades get so involved in them, then a lot of the assumptions go unchallenged or unexamined. But when you walk into it with a fresh set of eyes and being completely ignorant of what's going on, you can sort of look at things and say, well, that doesn't make any sense, or, you know, why aren't we doing this? And so your ignorance is kind of a benefit in that way, if you're willing to challenge your own assumptions and really approach it.
So what did you do first when you began thinking, huh, why is this? Why don't I have any black friends or black coworkers or black neighbors?
Well, the first thing I did was sort of define what I was going to look at, and I looked at what I sort of defined as the public square, which is schools, real estate, the workplace, and church. You know, I didn't want to look at the army or the music industry or something very specific that would have, you know, its own rules. I wanted to look at areas where we all should be interacting, but we don't. So I went back and looked at the history of school busing at my high school. I went back and looked at the history of racial covenants and residential segregation in the neighborhoods of Kansas City, which doesn't have a direct relationship to me, but sort of did in that the policies put in place there were transferred to Birmingham and other places where I lived through federal policy and also through personal connections between these real estate magnates who came up with these ideas. And then I looked at the advertising industry in New York and the failure of affirmative action to integrate that industry. And then I went back to Louisiana where I grew up and I looked at segregation in the Catholic Church because we grew up in southern Louisiana and our social life was grounded in the church. And so if there's no black people at church, you're not going to be going on any, you know, picnics and weekend holidays with them. So that was sort of how I decided to approach it and to sort of pull out the look at the universal by looking at the specific of where I came from.
Yeah. And so one of the first places you looked at was schools. And mm-hmm. you, as you just said, grew up in a suburb of Birmingham. You actually went back to look at your own, the high school you had gone to. What did you find?
I found a great improvement, and I was shocked to find it. When I grew up there, it was the place called Vestavia Hills. It was sort of the definitive white middle-class white flight suburb, not the old money suburb, but the new money white flight suburb of Birmingham. And they formed their own school system in, you know, object defiance of attempts to integrate the area schools, and their official school flag was the Confederate flag, and their official mascot was the Confederate rebel. So that sort of tells you what foot they were putting forward when they formed the school system there.
And so this was after the whole school desegregation effort, which, you know, Birmingham was ground zero for that. So your
right.
school was founded kind of in reaction. All the white people were like, whoa, let's
yeah,
head to the hills.
It was founded in 1970. All the white people had run to sort of the county system because the county system was still segregated after the cities had been integrated. And then the lawyers came after the county system. And once they put a court order on the county system to integrate, they ducked out of the county and formed their own municipality and passed a bond issue to raise money for their own schools. And then, of course, the lawyers didn't stop coming. Then they sued this new municipality for trying to avoid the law, and they won that. And the city was forced to have school busing. And so black students from really the poorest area of Birmingham, we're talking houses without running water, were bused into our wealthy white neighborhood. And what sort of stopped the friction over it was that the judge ruled that they wouldn't bus white students out into black areas, which was really white people's larger fear. When white people kicked and screamed when they tried to bus black students in, but then once a handful of black students came in and the world didn't end, you know, white people sort of more or less, you know, relaxed and took their medicine. But it was when they said, all right, well, we're busing all these Irish and Italian kids to 90% black schools. That's when the white flight exodus really just exploded. White people were like, okay, we're done.
Yeah, what's interesting about that is it sort of suggests that the way we looked at school desegregation and at busing was it was always for the benefit of the black kids, right? Oh, we'll take the black kids and we'll put them in the white schools because that'll be good for them, rather than
right.
saying, well, you know, there are costs of segregation for white kids, too. It's not good for white kids to grow up in all,
right.
in all white communities.
No, you grow up with a distorted view of the world, and you don't understand, society around you. And you live in this bubble where they pretend that racism doesn't exist. And so that can be damaging in its own way. But it was pretty destructive to try and – at the same time, and you should – you know, bring minority kids into a white environment to help everyone learn. But at the same time, integration is not just about learning to get along and learning how to understand each other. That's sort of like one element of it. That's sort of like the more touchy-feely multicultural element of it. As Dr. King defined it, the other side of integration is access to power, access to wealth, access to opportunity. And, you know, those opportunities are squarely on the white side of the aisle in this country. So to take 10 white kids and send them to a black school might be a culturally, you know, eye-opening experience, but it doesn't increase anyone's access to power. It doesn't increase anyone's access to economic wealth because that largely doesn't exist on the black side of the aisle. So that's why it was really kind of a mistake to try and send white kids the other way, because that's not really what integration is. Integration is the movement of disenfranchised groups into the power-sharing majority at the center of society.
But I have the feeling that you think that busing, for instance, desegregating the schools, really only went so far.
It did, because they tried to, rather than concentrating on areas where it would work, and they tried to essentially redraw the map. And I mean, when you go back and look at black and white society in 1968, they were two separate functioning societies. Black America was disadvantaged in terms of its access to resources, but it was a functioning society of its own social ecosystem, its own cultural norms, its own, you know, institutions, and that had a value to it. And white America was sort of set up to operate on its own rules. And so to try and just mash those two environments together was, kind of insane. It was, and so how it might have been treated better would be to give black families the leverage to migrate. I mean, you almost had to think about it in the same way that you think about immigration, because you were really moving from one country to another country. So rather than, you know, trying to smush these two societies together and make these two cultures function in an overlapping way, which was incredibly destructive and incredibly, you know, ignorant to try and do that, it was very grandiose, tilting at windmills. We failed on the count. We put all our energies into doing that, which failed, and we didn't really give black families the economic leverage to migrate to the country with all the money.
Well, one of the most interesting sections for me in your book is the long section when you look at housing. And I think you begin by saying that you came to the conclusion that the effort to desegregate the schools was really kind of cosmetic and masked the underlying issue, which was housing. How
right.
come?
Well, the Supreme Court ordered the states to, you know, end state and send, you know, state sanctioned segregation in schools, root and branch, was the phrase they used in the Supreme Court ruling. Well, in that formulation, the schools are just the branches. The roots of segregated schools, especially in large urban areas, are in the real estate. In the South, where like Birmingham and Atlanta were really the largest towns in the South, and even back then they weren't that big. So you really had these small towns where people lived in relative proximity. So busing people 5 minutes this way or that wasn't really a huge inconvenience, and it wasn't really a housing problem in the South. It was less of a housing problem in the South because the South had Jim Crow laws that kept people separate in their social norms. So you could actually live in relative proximity and yet be totally separate socially, because that's what the law mandated. In the mm-hmm. North, they really relied more on geographical separation to keep black people in their place. So then you had these ridiculous schemes. Like in Detroit, they wanted to bus 300,000 kids across 49 different independent school districts every day, once in the morning and once in the evening, which is just logistically impossible. So you had all these grandiose plans to shuffle kids all around the map. But if you pick up a kid at 8 a.m. and take him to school and then take him home again at 3:30, you're just basically putting him right back where he was, and you're not doing anything. You're not integrating him into the community of the school that you're bringing him to. He's just there for 8 hours a day. He sits on the other side of the cafeteria, and then he goes home. That's not integration. So the fact that we spent all this time and energy and billions of dollars investing in school busing without doing anything to deal with the underlying real estate issues was really a colossal error in judgment.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about what gets in the way of genuine racial integration in America. Talking with Tanner Colby. He's the author of Some of My Best Friends Are Black, The Strange Story of Integration in America. You can join our conversation. I'm curious, what do you think gets in the way of white and black people spending more time together? The number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email us. The address is talk@WPR.org. I'm Ann Strange Hampson. You're listening to 45 North on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. But in the true sense of the word, I'll be using what we've learned. In the true sense of the word, I'll be losing what we've learned. Right now we're talking with Tanner Colby, author of Some of My Best Friends Are Black. And Tanner, we were talking about housing, and you have a really interesting chapter on your case study is Kansas City. And you look at the growth of Kansas City's, really the creation of the white suburbs outside Kansas City. And I was reading it and thinking a lot about Milwaukee because, of course, here in Wisconsin, we have our largest city is Milwaukee, which is one of the most segregated cities in America. What did you learn about the whole history of how white suburbs were established?
I learned just how artificially they were created. And they were created really, as an advertising tool to make money. You know, what, as I said before in the segment, in the South you had Jim Crow laws that kept blacks and whites separate. Well, in the North they didn't have those laws, and they weren't going to get them passed because it was a different culture and different society. But as more and more blacks started moving north, whites started, you know, getting the same racial fears that they had in the South. And so white real estate developers realized that they could take advantage of that. Before 1900, there wasn't a single majority black neighborhood in any North American city. That idea didn't exist. The idea that, you know, white space should be kept all white, that idea hadn't been invented yet. And so when blacks moved up, they lived in working class and lower income neighborhoods. But if you were a black, you know, government clerk or earned a decent living, you would move into the corresponding, you know, white neighborhood. And so, but, you know, certain canny real estate developers, and foremost among them was J.C. Nichols out of Kansas City, realized that if you could create white real estate space, you could sell it at a premium and create, a profit off of that. So essentially what we did is we privatized segregation and put a profit motive behind it. And so they started creating all these new legal instruments for keeping land all white. First, they attached the, you know, this house may not be sold to a person of color to the deed of the house. And then they realized, well, if you attach it to the legal filing for the plat of the whole subdivision, then it applies to the whole subdivision. Then they realized if you make neighborhood associations legally responsible for enforcing those codes and make the purchase of the land incumbent with membership in this neighborhood association, then everyone in the neighborhood association is liable for protecting the whiteness of the land. And so in the South, when it came to defeating Jim Crow, you know, white people lost an inflated sense of social status and legal protection. Everywhere else, including the South, because the South had adopted it by that point, you know, the idea of losing the all-white status of your neighborhood threatened your bottom line because the inflated value of your real estate was based on it being all white. Mm. And so then after all the victories of the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act and you know, all of these civil victories, when it came to getting white people to give up white property, it was just a disaster. They didn't get anywhere. And the same Democrats that pushed through all these busing laws to integrate schools, when it came to trying to get a Fair Housing Act passed, they couldn't do it because even white Democrats in the North didn't want to give up the value of that their neighborhoods, because so ingrained was the idea that black neighbors would lower your property values. So what the Democrats ultimately settled for when the 1968 Fair Housing Act was really a watered-down, ineffectual plan that gave black homeowners really no recourse to try and sue for discrimination or to break down these racist laws that kept them out of neighborhoods. So we kind of forfeited the fight for fair housing in a lot of ways and left everything in place. And compounding that is that, you know, like I said before, no black person would have ever thought, well, we should have an all-black neighborhood. But after 40 years or, you know, 60 years of segregation, many black people had come around to the way of thinking, well, we should, you know, have our own spaces, and black neighborhoods are important for preserving black culture and black power and majority black voting districts. And so, you know, that took a lot of the pressure off in the fight for fair housing, because a lot of black people prefer a majority black neighborhood. Mm. And so today, once you adjust for income and you adjust for people's ability to move economically, you still have a lot of black people who prefer to live in a majority black area. And that's exacerbated by, you know, lots of structural problems. I know in Milwaukee there's been a lot of problems with public transportation and other things trying to diversify that area, and it's just not happening.
All right. I want to take a call. We've got Mike on the line from Richland Center. Hi, Mike.
Hi. Very interesting conversation here. I'm visiting right now home in Wisconsin. I grew up in Milwaukee, moved out east, and I try to get back whenever I can. I live in Baltimore, which is a city that's compared often to Milwaukee, my hometown, and in the size and the ethnic makeup and so on. But it is a 60% black city, and Milwaukee's quite a bit lower proportion of that. What I observe in a city that, you know, from its get-go, it was always majoritarian black-white city, pre-Civil War days, there is anger between the blacks and the whites. And I live in a neighborhood in the city, and my family, we decided we don't want to live in the suburbs. So the price we pay is that we're surrounded by neighborhoods that are low income and that generate most of the crime in the city. And it comes right up to our doorsteps on a regular basis. So even the most liberal Democrat-voting neighbors of mine, including me, you know, we reach a point where can't we get along? Apparently not.
But that's really interesting because you said you've chosen to live there, though, so you must think that the benefits outweigh the costs.
Precisely. And so I want progress. I want to figure out why it is there's so much crime. You know, typically we're talking about young black males with nothing going. They can't get through high school. You know, they have no families. They're not going to get jobs. They're stigmatized. And there's nobody really reaching out to help them in any way. And it's been that way in Baltimore, I think, for over 100 years.
Yeah.
Right.
Now, Milwaukee's a different story, right?
Yeah. So Tanner, what's your response to that? Because that plays right off a couple of the places that you looked at.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I haven't lived in Baltimore or Milwaukee, so I can't say how different they are. I think Baltimore obviously has a larger black community than Milwaukee. But a lot of the problems were created by federal policies. These are federal policies that were blanket across all urban areas when they really grew up in the 30s and 40s and 50s. So you do see a lot of identical patterns.
But there's this one neighborhood in Kansas City that you looked at. It's got a number. I can't remember what it is.
4963.
Yeah. It's got, I mean, that's a neighborhood that really tried, was a bunch of people who came together in that neighborhood and said, you know what, we don't want these separate but equal neighborhoods, and we don't want to live in an all white neighborhood. In fact, I think the first people you talked with, they moved to Kansas City, and the realtors said, oh, no, you don't want to live here. And they looked all around. They said, no, actually, we do want to live here. We want a multiracial neighborhood. But so then what happened?
Well, the problem was, and the way of thinking about it is not just that the federal laws discriminated against black people, but they discriminated against integration itself. You know, if you were white and you wanted to get a mortgage in an integrated neighborhood, you might be denied. You could be a white person with sterling credit and you would be denied a mortgage if you wanted to live in an area with black people, because the law said that, you know, integrated neighborhoods should not get mortgages. And so that's why once some black people started filtering into a neighborhood, it would flip completely black almost overnight. And so what this local group did was they said, we want to have a neighborhood where everyone's property rights are protected. Everyone who can qualify for a mortgage can get it. It was less about saying, oh, we want to be integrated. And it was more about, we want a space where people's property rights are protected, because that's fundamentally the problem in real estate segregation, is that black property rights were being denied. And so by creating a neighborhood where everyone's property rights were protected, which is actually a very conservative philosophy, it's not a liberal do-gooder philosophy, that then you created an integrated neighborhood. But the interesting thing about it is that really the best they managed was that blacks and whites coexisted. You know, it wasn't really an integrated neighborhood in terms of the melding of communities and relationships. That has only started to come in the last few years, and even then, it's barely happening. And that's one of the fascinating things about the history of racial integration, is that even where people sat down and said, we want to do this and we want to do it right and we want to make every good faith effort for years to make it happen, even in those cases, it barely works.
Mm-hmm. I want to go next.
Barely works.
Sorry.
Because of all the cultural differences.
Yeah. I want to go next to Ralph in Little Suamico. Hi, Ralph. How are you? I think you used to live in Milwaukee?
Yes. Hi. I lived in Milwaukee for 14 years, and it was primarily in the late 60s and into the 70s. And that was a time when they were really trying to develop some of the outer – well, it was still Milwaukee, but it was the far northwest side. And most of the new housing at that time, or a lot of it, was FHA housing. So, you know, it gave a lot of people an opportunity to move into these brand new homes, and that included all races. So after we moved in, we had a black family move in on both sides of our house. And they were hardworking, had concern about their family. And, in fact, my 10-year-old son, his best friend was one boy on one side. And so we socially got along fine. As neighbors would, we didn't go on trips together or anything, but we talked to each other and had no problems. But then what happened in Milwaukee was they decided that they had to bus a lot of the blacks in from the inner city. I'm not quite sure what the rationale was, but they brought in probably 10% of the population of the school came in from outside, bused in. And what happened to my son's friends were they basically started to shun him, and they started to associate with the new blacks that were moving in. And this not only disturbed me, but it disturbed their parents, which were both black parents on both sides, were disturbed that their sons were associating with a different class of people. I think it really was more of a class thing than a race thing.
But that's just so interesting, because Tanner, that's sort of the same story you talk about, where you see these pockets where neighborhoods really do figure it out for themselves. You know, there are these, the conditions are right, and they come together, and blacks and whites want to be friends, and especially they want their kids to be friends with each other. And then laws change, and really it's our formal efforts to desegregate wind up destroying this beautiful thing that had started in a neighborhood.
Right. Well, I mean, you do need formal efforts, in that you need formal efforts to get FHA loans to black families to live in the kind of neighborhood he's talking about. You know, there's an interesting anecdotal story about integration, that in 1965, if you'd asked a white family if he wanted a black, if he wanted black neighbors, he'd say, hell no. In 1975, if you asked a white man if he wanted a black neighbor, he'd say, well, I don't know, how much money does he make? In the sense that we do segregate by class, and that if you have an organic housing integration, the person living next door to you is going to make about what you make, and they're going to share, they're going to have the same educational aspirations for their children, and they're going to be, they want to become a part of your community. So it works. Which is why I sort of said before, it's about encouraging the migration from one country to another. Whereas if you take a huge chunk of people from the other side of town who are not really a part of the community, and you just insert them there, then you do sort of destabilize the social ecosystem there. So he's absolutely right. It does, it works much better when you have black parents voluntarily, you know, choosing to be neighbors with white people, and white people choosing to accept them.
You know, the other thing that I heard that he had to say reminded me so much of, of Barack Obama's speech recently that he gave in reaction to Trayvon Martin's death, when he was talking about how sometimes the kids can do what the parents can't. You know, sometimes we try to create neighborhoods or situations where it's the kids who will move forward. Actually, I think we have that clip. Let's hear a bit of what he said.
As difficult and challenging as this whole episode has been for a lot of people, I don't want us to lose sight that things are getting better. Each successive generation seems to be making progress in changing attitudes when it comes to race. Doesn't mean we're in a post-racial society. It doesn't mean that racism is eliminated. But, you know, when I talk to Malia and Sasha, and I listen to their friends, and I see them interact, they're better than we are. They're better than we were on these issues. And that's true in every community that I've visited all across the country. So, you know, we have to be vigilant, and we have to work on these issues, and those of us in authority should be doing everything we can to encourage the better angels of our nature, as opposed to using these episodes to heighten divisions. But we should also have confidence that kids these days, I think, have more sense than we did back then, and certainly more than our parents did or our grandparents did, and that along this long, difficult journey, you know, we're becoming a more perfect union. Not a perfect union, but a more perfect union.
I really liked that speech, and I found what he said really moving. What about you, Tanner? Do you think he's right?
I think it's absolutely true. And that's what, you know, when you go back to this neighborhood in Kansas City, you know, they created this integrated or this, you know, multiracial atmosphere. You wouldn't necessarily call it integrated, where blacks and whites coexisted. And, you know, the parents did not socialize. The parents barely even spoke to each other. But you talk to all the kids who grew up in that environment, and they grew up not knowing any different. To them, the racial divisions in the city make no sense. And black or white, the experience of growing up in that neighborhood changed them forever. And so that's really sort of why you integrate. You integrate for your kids, not you know, people ask me all the time, you know, how can I make black friends, or have you made any black friends? Like, I'm 38 years old and I'm married and I have a kid on the way. I'm not making any new white friends at this point, you know. I'm at mm-hmm. home. So, you know, it's really about getting to people while they're young, while they're in high school, while they're in college, to get them to understand the importance of reaching across the color line. But if parents can just agree to, you know, coexist, then we can, you know, hopefully raise our kids without passing this along to them. The problem is that we've created such huge structural barriers to get over. And it's, you know, it's hard for, you know, I know this gentleman who just called, he had black families that made it out to that neighborhood, but it is hard economically for a lot of black families to move out there. Yeah. And a lot of them don't know that they're going to be welcome or don't feel that they're going to be welcome. So they right. don't do it. And you actually have a substantial percentage of the black population that, you know, like I said, prefers to be on its own. And that those kids are being raised in a racially homogenous environment, just like white kids are being raised in a racially homogenous environment. So it becomes a problem, a self-perpetuating problem. We really need to concentrate on how we can get our kids, you know, in the same room. And not just in the same room and on opposite sides of the cafeteria, but actually participating in community together.
Oh, we had a Facebook message from Julie that I wanted to read. She says she and her husband adopted across color lines, and it's made a huge difference in their perspective on race. She says, we went into it thinking race didn't matter, even though we didn't have friends or neighbors of a different race. But our life has been so much richer since we've expanded our pool of friends, which now includes people of every color. We've also seen firsthand some of the challenges and inequities that people of color still face. She says, I will say it's hard to initiate those cross-cultural friendships, but so worth it. So, Tanner, let's talk a little bit, just in the, you know, 5 minutes we've got left. You know, you started the book realizing that you didn't really have friends who were black. I assume that over the course of writing the book, some of that changed, and you do now have some friends who are black. What was it like getting those friendships started?
You know, it was a long, slow process, and it was really less about, you know, I always say when I'm asked the question, how many black friends do I have now? I say that's the wrong question to ask. The question is, have I become the type of individual that a black person would choose to be friends with? Because, you know, white people love to say that we're not racist, and most of us aren't racist, but it's really more about the fact that if you don't know anything about race, if you don't know anything about the experience of people of color in this country, then there's nothing for black people to you know, grab onto in terms of having a relationship with you. It's very difficult. I'm at the point where I have trouble forming relationships with white people who are just too blithely ignorant of race, because I don't have anything to talk to them about when I talk about my work. And so by educating myself and just becoming a more aware and intelligent human being about the subject, black people have said, oh, he's all right. And, you know, friendships have just sort of happened naturally. So it's less about making the black friend and more about making yourself a better person that other people would choose to be friends with. Like this couple who's adopted the interracial kid, by showing that sensitivity of adopting the child and going through the learning process of raising that child, people of other races are more likely to say, okay, that's a white person that I can probably reach out to and have some sort of connection with.
Mm. We've got time for one really quick call. Will in Windsor. Hi, Will.
Yes. I want to thank your guests for shedding some light on the real problem with racism in this country. I grew up in Crystal Springs, Mississippi, graduated from a school of William H. Holtzclaw Memorial that was named after an African-American that started a junior college a few miles away. When the schools were integrated, they didn't integrate the school I graduated from. They moved all the African-American kids to Crystal High School and changed the name of the school I graduated from William H. Holtzclaw, the black man. I guess I was to do that was not to have white kids going to a school that's named after an African American.
Well, thank you. You've lived through some difficult history.
Yeah, that was pretty common in the South. If white kids were going to get bused to a black school, you know, the Harriet Tubman posters came down. They changed the name from George Washington Carver to Central High School. And they really did everything they could to deracinate it in every way.
Tanner, that's one of the common things you pointed out, we've talked a little bit about, we've been talking about the benefits of integration, but, you know, there are mixed feelings on both sides about that. Often in the black community, you know, there are mixed feelings about just how well it serves African-American families to completely integrate. Just in the tiny bit of time we have left, what do you see as the benefits of integration?
You know, integration is absolutely necessary in the sense that, you know, social networks and social capital are essential to getting decent jobs. You know, it really is, especially in a modern economy like we have, it's all who you know in a lot of ways. And if you don't know people on the white side of the color line, if you aren't forming those relationships, then you don't have access to employment networks. You don't have access to really the social and cultural capital you need to get ahead in this country. And so the fact that we live segregated lives is, you know, emotionally debilitating for white people, but it's really economically stagnating for minorities. So like when we talk about a lot of economic issues, you have to look at the social and cultural issues that lie underneath it.
Tanner, sorry, we're just running out of time, but Tanner, thank you so much for this has been terrific, and thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you very much.
Tanner Colby is the author of Some of My Best Friends Are Black, The Strange Story of Integration in America. The conversation continues on our Facebook page. If you've got a question or want to tell us what you think, visit the 45 North on Wisconsin Public Radio page. Don't forget to friend us while you're there. I'm Ann Strange Hampson. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Journalist Michelle Norris calls the conversations about race that we need to have, but often don't, the hidden conversation. Our public radio listeners know Michelle as an NPR special correspondent and co-host of All Things Considered. Back in 2008, she produced a series of conversations called The Race Card Project. And in the course of it, she discovered forgotten or hidden stories, even in her own family. So what began as a professional project turned into a very personal family memoir called The Grace of Silence.
I started listening to hidden conversations all over the place, including in my own family. The more I learned about these secrets that my parents sat on because they didn't want to clutter our path, they didn't want to poison our American experience with the pain from their past, I realized that I just couldn't let go of what I was learning, and I changed course.
The big revelation was a secret your father had kept, not only from you and your sisters, but from your mother.
Imagine that you're up in years. You've lived a full life. You've watched your children grow and become productive adults. And imagine that at some point you realize that the man that you had been married to for several years, you'd raised children with, had kept a tremendous secret from you. That he was shot when he was a young man, when he returned to Birmingham, Alabama, after his service in the military. And he never talked about it. Never told me, never told my mom. And imagine if you're that woman and you hear from that from your nosy daughter, which is exactly what happened.
What happened? How did you uncover this story in the first place?
Well, I learned about it from an uncle who just blurted it out one day while we were having breakfast. He was upset about young people not voting and that they took things for granted and they didn't realize that, you know, all the sacrifices that had been made years ahead of them. And he just said, well, you know, your father was shot. And he regretted saying it immediately.
Did he try to back
Well, he sort of pushed his food away and said, okay, you know, I'll tell you what I know, which was not much. So then I have to go through this sort of anthropological process to go to relatives who I thought may have known. And, you know, calling up people who I knew had this secret and trying to figure out how do I ask these elders to share this with me because they kept it a secret for a reason. Are they trying to honor my father's secret? And I would get one of two reactions. They would either say, oh, God, you know, Mickey, now you know, because my family calls me Mickey. Mm-hmm. And they would have the sense of, you know, heavy-hearted regret. Oh, okay, you found out. cat's out of the bag now. Or they would be really angry at me, and they would treat me like I was an 8-year-old again, and I was asking for, you know, a piece of pie that they weren't ready to give up. I mean, they would just fuss at me like, I can't believe that you're calling me again. Ask me about this. I don't want to talk about this. Don't go looking for this stuff. And, of course, I couldn't – the daughter in me couldn't let it go. The journalist in me couldn't let it go. I felt this magnetic pull, and I just had to keep knocking and knocking and knocking on doors until I finally got people to talk to me about it. And then I realized I had to go to Alabama because that's really where the keys to the story were. And in that sense, I got lucky because I found documentation.
But it's like pulling on a ball of yarn.
Yeah.
You know? You just kept pulling and pulling. But clearly, it was a tremendous shock to you.
It was hard for me to swallow this, in part because of the man I knew. My father was a postal worker who raised his kids on the south side of Minneapolis. He was a by-the-book guy. He was very gentle and very kind, you know, the sort of quiet wisdom about him. And he was very optimistic, and people liked to be in his orbit because of that.
So this really doesn't fit with the picture of a young man who was shot by a white police officer.
And it wasn't just that the picture of him being shot. It was what led up to the shooting. My dad returned to Birmingham at a period where the city was full of black veterans who were coming back. And they came back as changed men. And they were met with disappointment and rejection time and time again. And my father, what surprised me so much, given what I knew about him, is that he was on that February evening in 1946 trying to enter a public building, and a policeman tried to stop him, and he stood up to the policeman. He confronted the policeman, which is something I just could not imagine. This is a guy who would, like, fuss at us if we jaywalked. He stood up to this police officer, and a scuffle ensued, and the police officer's gun went off, and that's when he was, the bullet grazed the side of his leg.
I mean, put that in some context. What does that mean for a young black man to stand up to a police officer?
In the first 6 weeks of 1946, half a dozen returning black veterans were killed by police officers in and around Birmingham. One of them was shot because there was a colored-only sign, and he said, I'm wearing a U.S. military uniform. I don't need to honor that sign. I'm going to move it. And in that case, a scuffle ensued, and he was shot in the head. His name was Timothy Hood. He died. There were cases where they were trying to vote, and if they knew that they were trying to vote, meaning the authorities, they might be visited in the dark of night. I mean, it was throughout the year 1946, this was not limited to Birmingham. Across the country, black veterans were beaten and burned and lynched, castrated, maimed. It was the blinding of a black veteran 3 hours after he was honorably discharged from the Army that so troubled Harry Truman that he appointed the commission that led to the full integration of the armed services. And I tried to talk to veterans who were returning to America at that time to understand what life was like for them. And not all of them that I talked to faced violence, but they did face a certain degree of marginalization when they returned. And they certainly were marginalized in the military because of the strict codes of segregation. And what they describe is this moment where they just decide that their manhood is more important than the strictures that have been forced down their throat all their lives.
And they had lived in the military with a different code and a different sense of who they were and how much respect they were due. And they're supposed to put that down when they come home?
Mm-hmm. So many of them painted a picture that began to make sense to me when I looked at my dad's life. If you had that experience, it would be easy to live the rest of your life as a malcontent, to speak out and sort of live on the fringe of life and just say, forget it. I'm not going to play by anybody's rules anymore. Instead, they took a different course. These men are almost like a social cohort. They tended to follow a very similar path. They decided collectively to live these lives of utter rectitude. I mean, they went the other way. Instead of like saying, I'm not going to follow anybody's rules, they followed the rules to the letter. They dressed impeccably. They kept their homes just so. Their cars were always, you know, you could see yourself in the chrome. They made sure that no one could ever complain about them at work.
They became model minorities.
They became model minorities, and they tried to raise model minorities. And they put all their ambitions in their kids and in this belief that they could prove to America that they belonged and that they were worthy of respect. They decided not to pass on their anger? Because they didn't manifest that anger, but I have to believe that it was there.
Burdens like that can also be inherited. Is there a feeling that you have to prove something to make up for your parents' pain?
Well, I feel that all the time. I feel like I have to prove something to the world in small ways. I mean, that was drummed in me so much, you know, that based on your achievements, the door's going to open a little bit wider for someone who comes behind you. Or maybe that door won't open at all if you don't go out there and rock the world. I mean, they wouldn't use that terminology, but it was always there. I felt that all the time.
Do you think that I feel
that today, and I'm not going to lie to you, I really do. I feel that sometimes when I sit in front of the microphone, that I may help some other person of color, some other woman, someone else who, you know, doesn't come from an Ivy League school, you know, who hails from the Midwest, as I do, an opportunity to get in the door and make their own way. That's something that is so deeply ingrained in my DNA that you know, society might change. Opportunities might open, you know, for other people a little bit, you know, more broadly. But that is always there. And I don't know that it's a wound. I choose not to see it as a wound. It just is.
What about the long-term impact of stories like this? You track down some older people who were living in Birmingham mm-hmm. at the time, 1946. And I'm thinking about a conversation you had with a woman named Julie Beaton.
Julia's older brother, John, was with Dad the night he was shot. And she carried so much anger with her. I mean, more anger than I have ever heard expressed by any member of my family. And she told me things I didn't know. She told me stories about my grandparents coming home from a church revival dressed in all white, and a car full of kids, white kids, came careening down the street, and they threw rotten tomatoes at them while they were wearing all white clothing. And how, you know, she watched this happen as a kid, and she's so angry about it to this day. She's angry about having to go to the movies and paying for a ticket and then going outside around to the fire escape in the back and walking up to the balcony, you know, to watch a film. She's angry about having to sit in a certain part of the bus or having to step off the sidewalk. I mean, all these things still live inside her. And she talked about, you know, how she doesn't trust white Americans.
And she said her grandsons hate white Americans.
Yeah, she did. She did. And I called her back and I said, "No, you sure? I know you said this and you know you said this, but this is going to be in print. Are you okay with this?" And she said, "You know, people need to understand what segregation did to some of us." And I decided to include that in the book for just that reason. You know, anger wasn't manifest in my family in quite that way. That was not the message that I got in my home. And I thought it was important to include it to show the contrast between her experiences and my family's, but also to include it because we talk so much about this honest conversation about race in this country. And if we truly want to have an honest conversation, those are the kinds of things that you might hear.
I was going to ask, is this the kind of conversation about race that you think we need to have?
I don't know if it's the kind that we need to have, but I don't know. I know it's the kind that we might not be able to avoid if we really want to be honest about this. And it's really complicated because imagine if she said that in a studio like this in front of a microphone, how people would react to something like that. Imagine if she said that in the course of a cable television program, your eyes are widening now. I mean, imagine that. It would be blown up and probably repeated because, ooh, this is what happens when people try to talk about race. What I learned in the experience of doing these conversations and what I learned in the course of working on this book is that the conversations can be painful and yet still productive if they are in safe spaces. But, you know, the other reason that I thought this was important is because of the message that she's passed on to her children. And, you know, when we think about race relations in America and we think about the hill we still have to climb, we often think about it in terms of white attitudes about black America, that white America still looks through sort of a shaded lens at black America. But what we don't consider all the time is the message that black Americans pass on to their own kids, too, that their attitudes, that there's a healthy amount of distrust on both sides. And that's a painful but important part of that equation.
Michelle Norris is one of the most trusted names in American journalism. She's a special correspondent for NPR and has been co-host of All Things Considered. Her book is called The Grace of Silence.
I'm Ann Strainchamps, and you're listening to 45 North on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.